This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I have the great pleasure of talking to B.A. Van Size. He's the author of and photographer of an amazing book called The On the National Language, The Poetry of America's Endangered Tongues. It's a large-sized book with photo and text. I'm very sorry that everyone listening cannot see it because it's an extraordinary book with really just beautiful photographs. So thanks for doing this, BA.
Thank you. Thank you. I'd say joining me, but we're separated by a very large ocean. So perhaps joining is the wrong word.
Well, we can say join because it's virtual. And nowadays, we could be doing this. You could be on the shuttle going to the moon. So it'd be all right.
Oh, but your lips to God's ears. Could you imagine the projects I could do on the moon?
Oh, yeah. That would be cool. Well, no language, though.
No, but I'm sure I'll find something to do.
So you identify yourself as a photojournalist. Maybe you could talk a little bit about your background and, you know, just where does this book come from in the context of your work?
So I think it's complicated. I usually say photojournalist as shorthand, and also because it's sort of the hat that I've worn the longest and probably the easiest to wear. I was a credentialed photojournalist for both New York local and national news outlets for about a quarter century, and then in about 2016, I got sick. I had a very massive surgery and kind of departed from that and went into sort of doing these very large format and in both senses of the word, projects where I would sort of do these deep dives into what I usually refer to as being classes of people that are usually united by some aspect. More often than not, it's language. So I like language. I have a degree in language from Fordham University. And my first one was about notable American poets. So Pulitzer Prize winners, poets laureate, members of the Academy of American Poets, really sort of these important literary artists. My second project was about the post-war refugee experience of Holocaust survivors in America. And this most recent one is called On the National Language, which came out in late September and is currently a unbelievable, will knock your socks off exhibition at the Skirball Cultural Center in Los Angeles, which is about endangered language learners, speakers, and revitalizers. So for each of these products, it's kind of the same gist with the poets and the language revitalizers. I spent 3 years kind of driving around the country in a Hyundai meeting people with the Holocaust survivors, as long as about six. Go and meet these folks and learn from them. You know, the way it'd probably be a little closer to the truth to say that I'm an artist and an author at this point, but still there's an aspect of journalism to it because you are still bound by a sense of experience that is, I think, perhaps a little more common to photojournalists.
Right, but big difference for you when you're doing a book is that you have more, I mean, it is still, photojournalism is still narrative, but books are narrative in a different way, and they're less ephemeral for one thing, but also this gives you the opportunity to tell a story in a more cohesive way with more control. I am imagining that this is the part that I don't really know how you manage this, but to travel for that long a time, talking to so many people, and then weave together the narrative because you have so many different elements to the story. And I assume you may start with a rough idea of what you're going to do, but that it changes as you do it.
Yeah. I think there's a natural inclination among journalists. You go out to cover a story, but I've actually never found that to be true my whole life. I find more often than not, the story finds you. With my Holocaust survivor project, it certainly changed over the course of doing it. With my language project, it changed. It went from one project to another, and then even changed within that project. Because what happens is you go out and you meet people, right? And you learn pretty quickly when you get on the ground doing things what the actual story is, and it very rarely matches your own expectations. And we know this just as being humans functionally and living lives, right? Whatever dreams you may have when you're younger, you imagine, oh, this is my spouse is going to look like this, and my house is going to look like this, and X and Y and Z is going to look like this. But in reality, the life that finds you, which may still be quite lovely, is very rarely the one you go out looking to find. With my projects, which for me are done primarily out of a sense of a desire for this personal gratification of learning from people, I find more often than not that I get started and find out that, oh, what I thought I wanted to do was not actually this. With National Language, you know, I spent 3 years, met 100 people, did all these conceptual portraits and got to learn about all these languages and hear these languages, et cetera. It started out, I was driving around Oklahoma and I was working on a project about the Oklahoma landscapes. That is how this actually started. I had a family in Oklahoma. I've been spending a lot of time out there, and I was doing a project about how there's a sort of very retro neon, leave it to Beaver, trip back to the 50s thing going on in Oklahoma that punctuates these endless plains of undulating grass. And I was very interested in that visually. And it got to the point that that everyone didn't kill me is remarkable. I had almost finished the book. It was called Sooners Later. I like the title very much.
But great title. Yeah, really great.
So those things, right? Because they were all night or like crepuscular white landscapes. I had arranged the author for the foreword, a wonderful singer named Ben Rector, who was from Tulsa, Oklahoma, and is an incredible poet himself. I talked to the publisher about it. Everything was lined up. And then I was out there working on the project, doing a few, the very last plates. It was going to be a 56-plate book. And my godson is an enrolled member of the Cherokee Nation. And he was little and he didn't really give a shit. But, you know, I wanted to take him to the Cherokee Heritage Center in Talco, Oklahoma. So I packed him in the car. Hey, Uncle B is going to take you down to go and see the Cherokee Center. And we're driving down there. He falls asleep and I hear a radio interview with Dwayne Johnson. Who was talking, he's promoting, I assume, Moana or something. I've never been able to find it. And he was talking about how he had success and all this incredible notoriety. And I'm sure the money's a part of it too, whatever. But he still put this hole in him because his mother was Samoan. He didn't have that connection necessarily to the Samoan culture and couldn't speak the language and didn't know much beyond a few songs, et cetera. And all of a sudden, you know, there's an expression in theater that you have to use real props because, you know, if you use a fake coin and it hits the stage, everyone can tell that it's fake. And if you use a real coin, everyone does that too. And suddenly I was driving my nephew who was asleep in this car on the way to Oklahoma. And all of a sudden I hear the sound of a real coin hit the stage. And it started from there. You know, so it wasn't even the same project, but as soon as I got started meeting these people, as soon as I got started going to these places, which I wouldn't necessarily be going to, and in meeting these folks I wouldn't otherwise have occasion to meet, I realized that, like so many other dreams in life, the beauty had found me.
So you started it. I mean, I'm going to ask some geographical questions because the book covers not every single language in the country, obviously, that is threatened or spoken by a small number of speakers or in revival, which is, I mean, those are really three categories that are connected. But
it's really important. Actually, it's different. Yeah.
So you can't, you didn't cover them all, obviously, but you started in Oklahoma where, because of the terrible history of America's relationship with indigenous people, there are more native languages in Oklahoma, probably in one area than any other place. That's what I'm guessing.
Might be true. That might be true. So it's always important to me to stress, it's actually not a Native American project. It feels like that to a lot of folks, and I understand why. If I had done the project in Asia or Europe or Africa, it would have been the exact same project focused on languages in those places. Because I did it in the United States, it becomes heavily indigenous because those are the languages in greatest peril in the U.S. because of exactly those legacies you mentioned. If you're talking about genocide and forced removal, if you're talking about especially talking about Native American language, you're talking about the boarding school system. If you're talking about those projects and those reasons for language endangerment, then you get into that. I mean, the vast majority of the folks who I got to work with are native, but I don't personally characterize as a native project.
No, no, and I didn't mean to do that. I was just thinking.
No, I'm just expounding.
Right.
And so I started in Oklahoma because that was kind of part of it. That's where I don't want to say it was easier to find folks, but it was easier to find some of these programs that were working on language revitalization. Now, it's important to note, I like to be clear on this. When I started this, I think, you know, you have a responsibility to sort of admit one's own defects and problems. When I started this, my original idea was this really, I don't want to say ugly, it was well-intentioned, but colonialist view of, oh, I want to go photograph the last speakers of these languages. And then I got like three in and realized, oh no, there's all these cool young people who are on the ground who are trying to bring back the languages. And what a stupid, fucked up idea that was. That, you know, when the story that finds you, the beauty that it finds you is actually, no, there's these, you know, people who are kids who are on the res and in cultural centers or in Amish farms, they're doing X and Y and Z, and they're working to save their languages and their cultures. And the story finds you.
And in some ways, what's really interesting, one of the things I noticed that you had talked about with some of the people is that they are they're reviving a language that had, in fact, disappeared from active conversation. And as language is the reflection of culture, you know, it's really complicated to revive a language when you don't have all the elements of the culture anymore. Or there is also the question of, you know, the idiomatic pronunciations and the difficulties of knowing what orthography was used. And, you know, and also, I mean, in the way that a lot of languages were saved, they were written down by people who were not speakers. They were written down by linguists and anthropologists who were doing the best they could, not knowing the languages themselves, you know, just trying to record them. I mean, it's a really amazing, and we also, as you mentioned, that we have other languages, not just native cultures, languages of people who have come to America and created new languages here. I mean, some of the, I thought that I was pretty conversant in this area, you know, this field, but you actually brought out some languages that I had not even heard of, didn't realize existed, that are just, they sound amazing. Yeah.
There's so many of them. And what's remarkable is that it's in a certain way, a testament to the missteps that we've had on this continent, which are not unique to this continent, but also it's a testament to the phenomenal diversity that you find here, which is perhaps a little more unique. You know, this is one of the few countries in the world, really, where you can move here and become of here, which is a unique, kind of unique concept to the United States and a handful of other countries. You know, there's a reality that all of these cultures come here, and you could talk about, you know, for instance, you talk about the descendants of slave languages. You talk about Gullah and Afro-Seminole Creole and the Creoles they have in Louisiana and such. And you can talk about those incredible legacies that were very purposefully beaten and buried. And you have folks on the ground who are saying, well, that's great. That's nice. Oh, we don't care. We're going to try and bring back as much as we can. And they have to use really crazy, diverse, and challenging sources. You mentioned about the idea of a language revival, right? You can't talk about language revival in this country without talking about Wampanoag, which is most folks don't know what that is. It's the language that the natives of Massachusetts spoke when the Pilgrims met them.
Well, it was, you know, one of the tribes, because
one of, yes.
Right.
The first language that they met when they landed was that, of the many that were up in New England. And you know, that language was, there's a word you're not allowed to use in Native American language circles that if you're in traditional linguistic circles, you do, which you say language is extinct. You'll often hear folks in Native circles say the language is dormant. That's largely because of Wampanoag. That's largely because of the idea that a woman named Jessie Little Doe Baird, who a very interesting woman, the speaker who posed for me in this book is actually her grandson. And she said, well, I want to bring back this language and the culture inherent in it after 300 years. And the source that she had to use and had is kind of the word is insane. She used the Bible.
Right.
Because the pilgrims wanted to proselytize. And so they had the entire Bible in a one-to-one. You're talking about linguists who necessarily weren't in the culture. It's the forcing of a culture upon them that was used in turn to restore their own. And there's so many avenues like this where you see, you know, the African American linguists going back to Africa, going back to African linguists and saying, well, we don't really understand what this word is, but but we can actually find it in X or Y or Z West African language. Aha, that's where it comes from. That's where perhaps the origins of the folks who came here and made us come from. You're playing a lot of connect the dots. So while you're learning the language, you're also kind of learning yourself. You're finding your own DNA. You're finding your own sort of path back through the footsteps that led you to the ones under your own feet.
Right. I think that reminds me of a show I watched on public television and now, of course, cannot remember the name of, but it was a chef going back to try to understand the roots of African American cooking. And of course, that brings you back to Africa because of the food ways. But it also is it's the same story. It's the same investigation to learn the language because the words are, and food is, particularly language is really interesting. You know, when I studied linguistic historical change, the inventory of words that change the slowest are the ones that are most core to a culture. So food and the word for God or the word for the people, those words change slower over time. So food, so the words in African-American culture that apply to food that was brought from Africa are pretty clearly related. You know, so what you're describing makes sense. I'd imagine that would be true all over our hemisphere, if you will, the Western hemisphere in its tracking back the people who came here from the Eastern, you know, from the other side of the world, that they brought with them their language and their and their culture. And then as the accretion of cultures, they brought a lot of the language, even though the speaking of the language went, ended, and went dormant, as we want to say.
The English language, which is highly larcenous, behaves a lot like amber. You know, it finds the bug and it subsumes the bug, but the bug remains intact. You can see so many words from so many languages that English is steamrollered over from so many cultures that had also joined in diaspora American life. And you see them existing. The language has changed a lot, except for those core ideas, right? God is God, is God, and it's changed. You came back and you're talking to pilgrims, they're talking about God, and they're talking about certain native concepts. You see them preserved as well in native communities even now. You know, those maintain, but it's constantly in flux. Everything changes all the time. You know, if 100 years from now, if someone's listening to our podcast, they might not understand us so easily.
Well, that's true. And actually, that came up in one of the, I can't remember the language that includes a lot of French from the era of Versailles, which makes sense because the original speakers of it came to America in the 17th.
The Sun King. It's Uma French. It's right. Kirby Verrett holding an actual alligator in his hands.
Right. That was a great, I mean, it's really, I mean, you see that in Appalachia where there are words that were brought from Scotland and Ireland in the 1700s and they've survived. You'll see it in Maine with
Downeasters.
Yeah. French, you know, French speakers mm-hmm. who have become Americans or in Quebec, the Quebecers, mm-hmm. Quebecois, who speak French that is real. And it's also true, I think, in Brazil with Portuguese, mm-hmm. where there are Brazilians can understand Portuguese. A lot of the Portuguese can understand a lot of the Brazilians.
If you ever want a wild time, have you ever heard of Ocracoke English?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I've been to Ocracoke. Yeah.
So for your listeners who might not be aware of it, there's a sandy little spit of land off the coast of Virginia and North Carolina, where through isolation, they fundamentally still speak the same Eastern British dialect that their fishing ancestors brought over in the early colonial period, almost without change. Now, modern technology has made it grow a lot closer to English over the last 20 years. But if you'd set foot there 30 years ago, you would have had a very, very hard time understanding these folks who were speaking English in America.
Yeah, when I went to Ocracoke was about 1980. And I experienced that. It was amazing. And they went to Gullah country at the same time, which was mm-hmm. very difficult to understand.
My father was a Navy guy. We went to Norfolk a lot when I was a kid. And I remember actually going to Ocracoke and being like, what the hell are these people saying? This is not, they were quite sure they were speaking English and I was quite sure they were not. It was an absolute trip.
Well, and speaking of that kind of language accretiveness, I think that also happened in North Carolina, South Carolina, where slaves fleeing into the marshes met up with Native Americans and the mm-hmm. Remnants of a lot of tribes that had early contact with settlers, European settlers, and had their populations decreased by disease, ended up living together and creating essentially the Lumbee tribe, mm-hmm. which was a combination of a lot of different cultures. In Connecticut, where I live, we have the similar situation with the Paugussets, which is a very small remnant, but still was here. Bridgeport, Stratford, where I live, was all Paugusset country. And mm-hmm. They were very early on, like Wampanoags, lost a lot of their language in the colonial period. But and of course, the white culture thinks they've disappeared, but they still are here.
Nothing ever disappears. You know, I have some distant native heritage. I don't identify as native. I make a point to not do that because we live in a world full of these pretendians who make a point. And I'm certain not that, but I have some native heritage. I'm in a genealogy. I am enrollable in one of those Canadian tribes. And the whole history of those folks is, it's a very similar story to what you see with the Lumbee, where it's the French came in and met the natives and the English came in and everybody met and married and or maybe didn't marry and still made kids and till it becomes this sort of ship of Theseus of ethnicity in a certain way, you know, where it becomes a lot harder to find who someone is or isn't. And the only thing that really holds folks together, perhaps, are shared bonds.
Yeah. And that's, of course, now with DNA, people are able to prove or disprove the stories of their families mm-hmm. Passed down over generations, because it becomes often oral history that is either made up or forgotten.
And things fall away too, right? So my father, when we took a DNA test, the native DNA shows up for him and not for me. I'm the spot where it falls apart, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what happens in families where these things sort of fall out over time, because you only keep your DNA for X number of generations, and then we all sort of mix with so many other folks that we become something new.
Right. Well, let's see what I was going to ask you. Oh, did you consider the possibility of going to Queens, New York, and spending as much time there, where there are more languages spoken, I think, than any place else in the world? I was just wondering whether, whether that would be just too much to do.
So I live in Queens, New York, so it would have been hard to get to Queens, New York. There's a project that is controversial in the native language revitalization circles, which I'm going to be polite and not name. The guy who runs it is controversial. It is controversial, and it focuses especially on languages that are in New York. And I wouldn't have really had that opportunity, though I did do a few of the pictures in New York, because of the way that I defined American endangered language. I defined it as a language that is endangered, the majority of whose speakers are in the United States.
Ah, okay.
This discounts almost everything in Queens, because there's a million endangered languages that live in Queens, where almost certainly, without exception, the majority of those speakers still live back in the old country somewhere.
Right.
And so that wasn't really an opportunity to me, although there's one Bukhari that's in the book where the majority of speakers live in New York, and a couple of those that I did in New York. But you know, I happen to love living in the world's borough for partly for that reason. But it wasn't exactly within the confines that I set up for myself so that I wouldn't go crazy me doing this the rest of my entire life that prevented that.
Right. No, I think that you do have to have parameters. I think that's actually really good to point out that it makes it possible to live within the boundaries then if you do have some parameters. And it also makes the book possible to end without feeling like you could create four more books.
You know, I do all my projects in multiples of 18. It's good for me personally. It's good for page numbers, et cetera. And the biggest question I get when events that I did at the museum, when I talk about this book in general is, well, gee, willikers, jeepers, where's Mexico? Mm-hmm. And my answer is I'd be doing it till I died if I tried to include Mexico. You know, there's, depending on how you want to define it, the way I define it, there's about 140 endangered languages that are primarily in the United States. I got to about 100 of them. I feel great with that. I had to stop early because I had a medical problem that I temporarily lost use of my legs, and that pretty much put a stop to it where I was. But if I had included Mexico, it increases the number by hundreds and hundreds. If I'd included Canada, it would have increased by like three. But Mexico would have just murdered me. You have to find a place to stop. Otherwise, it consumes your whole life.
Right. Well, and you're an American also, so there's a, you know, makes it easier to do a book about America. Is there anybody that you didn't get to see to include in the book that you sort of feel like you wish you had?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few. There were a few who were visually interesting. There was one fellow who I drove all the way to North Dakota, and he didn't show up, and then ghosted me. And it's a shame because he was visually unbelievable. But no, the biggest challenge for me is that I had to have this stopping point because the exhibition could go up pretty quickly, and the curators are so good at the museum that they didn't really need a lot of any involvement, particularly for me. But the books take a while to get going, and so I had about a year before that I had to deliver the book. And I had lined up a bunch of the Pacific languages that I was going to do almost all of them in Hawaii. And that was going to be the last thing. It was going to be a nice treat after having done this project where almost all of the shoots involve, you know, fly 8 hours, drive 8 hours, go up a long dirt road to somebody's hut. I was looking forward perhaps to going to Hawaii and doing a bunch of these. And I'd lined up, I think, about seven that were going to be there. That was going to be the last seven I was going to do. And it was... It was Samoan and, of course, the Hawaiian language, also Hawaiian pidgin and Hawaiian sign language is going to be pretty cool. There's one woman named Linda Lambrecht who does Hawaiian sign language, which is functionally pretty challenged. I was going to do a whole bunch of those. And it was just, I had a weird reaction to antibiotic. I lost the use of my legs. I did most of Alaska with these giant Forrest Gump leg braces on me. And, deadlines happen, and that was that. But I would have definitely liked the idea of closing it out in paradise.
Yeah, I would imagine so. Well, yeah. There's one more thing I wanted to ask you about. I noticed, and now this is just, you know, kind of my personal perspective, but when I was most involved in studying linguistics was a long time ago, and some of the languages that I studied or knew about were not as endangered or threatened 50 years ago. And what mm-hmm. struck me was how rapidly languages that, and I'm not an expert, so this was purely just perspective, but languages that I did not even think would be threatened mm-hmm. are.
So the part, a big part of that is convenience, and a big part of that is just the encroachment of a larger society. You know, I spent a week hanging out on an Amish guy's farm, wonderful guy, very hard to earn the trust of an Amish man to photograph him when it's forbidden in their religion. So spent about a week there milking his cows and hanging out with him and his wife and his daughter. And his biggest concern was that he knew, as many other folks in the community did, that his daughter, like a lot of folks in the community who were younger, his daughter was 16, he knew that somewhere or other she had a secret cell phone. Now, he wasn't particularly worried that she was going to, I met this girl. She was a great kid. He wasn't worried that she was like using it to orchestrate Amish drug deals, or she wasn't, you know, looking up, you know, pornography. He was worried that while she was using this cell phone, that she was secretly and privately outside of the ears and eyes of her parents speaking English with her friends. And that's a big part of it, right? You know, languages flourish in isolation, when you have someone to talk to, when you have a reason to have it. Now, in our modern world, if you, let's say, before the call, you're mentioning how you have family who live out amongst the Navajo out in Arizona. If you want to go to the 7-Eleven out there to go and buy, you know, bread, milk, and Pampers, you don't need to speak Diné to do that transaction. You don't need the language for everyday life. You may need it to speak to grandma and grandpa, but eventually grandmas and grandpas die and the language becomes less utile to you as you go forward in the world. That's the big challenge for a lot of these languages. That's also why the languages that I see personally doing the best in the revitalization programs, the ones for which I am most optimistic, are the ones where the majority of the program is dedicated to, well, we're going to do an immersion program for like preschoolers. So preschoolers can and do use the language because they'll say, Tommy, I want to play with the blocks. And they'll say it in macaw or whatever. And they have a purpose to use it. Which is something that perhaps realistically their parents don't always have. They had their courtship and their marriage in English. They go to the store, they go to Home Depot and buy lumber in English or whatever, right? So it gives a new outlet for actual useful language usefulness, I guess.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And of course, the other thing that happens is there's a downward spiral. If when you have 200 or 400 speakers, it's not enough, but it's still enough. But if you are down to 10 or 15, the vitality of the language is much more difficult to maintain. There aren't enough people to talk. And then what you described as the older people dying off, there aren't enough younger people willing to invest the time to learn it, to maintain it.
There's a man who I spoke to who I wanted to include in this project, and I'm going to be purposely vague on this, who was a member of one of the native tribes out in Oklahoma, and he was the last speaker of his language in the world. And there wasn't really a robust, there isn't really a program for his language on the res out there. It's him. And I was put in touch with him. I called the tribe. The tribe put me in touch with the chief. I talked to the chief. The chief said, okay, call. And I'm going to call this guy Bob for the sake of being vague. And I got on the phone, called up Bob. He was prepped that I was going to be calling him. I called him up and he said, what's the point? I'm the last person. I have no one to talk to. When I die, so will the language. And that's a really real thing. I know you read the book. I opened the book by talking about a guy named Matteo Bartoli, who was an Italian linguist. And, you know, he went out to go and learn the Dalmatian language because he'd heard of a guy whose parents spoke the language and he wanted to go and meet someone who spoke before it disappeared. And the language disappeared very promptly after he met this man with the death of that fellow. And, you know, languages very frequently die with the death of one person, but also, as we've seen with Wampanoag, they also are saved from apocalypse by one person as well.
Yeah, that's true. I thought about the California, the number of languages spoken in California, I think at contact was around 300. Many of those mm-hmm. tribes were really small, and many mm-hmm. of them, not only did the tribe disappear, well, the language disappeared because the tribe disappeared for a variety of reasons, but yeah. there's been a lot of restoration language projects in California, and it's just, I'm struck by how wonderful that effort is, because it means that cultures can be revived, and that mm-hmm. what is imagined to have been lost can be saved or revivified, because it won't be the same as it was. It will be something new.
But neither is English, neither is German, neither is any other language.
Right, they're all language changes. It's not, we don't have Latin, but people still understand it, and there's a purpose for it. So,
The primary, even if I mentioned California, the primary reason why the premier exhibition, because it's touring afterwards, the premier exhibition of it is in California specifically. I had the choice. It's a choice that would seem crazy if you asked any artist in the whole wide world about what I picked. I had the choice between the Skirball Cultural Center in Los Angeles and an absolutely massive, world famous, everybody in the planet has heard of it museum. And I picked the Skirball. It to me was a no-brainer. A part of that was that it was in California, and there's just so much really cool stuff happening with language revitalization in California. And because of that, exactly that example, it had a greater density of diverse languages, and we know this, than almost anywhere in what's now the United States upon the point of colonial contact. And we know this because the Spanish, while being fairly horrible to everyone, were also pretty nerdy about it. And they were interested in the language. They were talking about it, and they were writing about it. And they were talking about the different poetry practices of different tribes up and down the coast as they met them and different linguistic practices. So we know a lot about those languages. And, you know, when you come from a place that had the most devastation, perhaps, of sort of their native linguistics, to also some of the most robust and interesting and youthful language programs, it made sense to me to say, okay, well, if we're going to start this, let's start it in that backyard, you know? And it made a lot of sense.
Oh, it does. It's great. Well, and I'm glad you mentioned poetry. I know we pretty much have run out of time, but it is important to at least note that it's not only the poetry of America's Endangered Tongues in the title, that you actually have poetry in the book, which I really appreciate. So I would like to recommend this book to anybody who's listening. It's a terrific book. And thanks again, B.A., for talking to me. This has been Writer's Cast. I've been talking to B.A. Van Cise about On the National Language, the Poetry of America's Endangered Tongues. It's a spectacular book, and hopefully somebody listening is going to be able to go to the Skirball and see the exhibit.
Thank you, David. I appreciate it so much.